All aboard and welcome to Crit Club, the podcast where four friends watch movies from the Criterion Channel streaming service that none of them have seen before. This week, we head to Bisbee, Arizona, where there's a legend and a rumor when you take the 310 to Yuma that you can see ghosts of outlaws go riding by. Cows roam the desolate hills and ranchers barely stay afloat amid an ongoing drought. But before we mount our horses, let's introduce our panel. I'm your host, Angela. And with me, as always, is Wizard Chris.
Hello, I'm Wizard Chris. I'm rootin', I'm tootin', I'm salutin'.
Corey?
Hi, I'm Corey. I have nothing clever to say.
And Peter.
I'm glad my last name is not Butterfield.
And I'm trying to think of something Western to say with this voice, but all I can do is think of this voice. Howdy, Angela.
Heck.
Howdy, Peter. This week, we're watching American Western classic 310 to Yuma, directed by Delmar Daves and starring Glenn Ford, Van Helfen, and Felicia Farr. Van Helfen plays rancher Dan Evans, whose cattle get caught up in a botched stagecoach robbery. Needing $200 to pay to water his cows in an ongoing drought, Mr. Evans takes on the dangerous job of transporting stagecoach robber Ben Wade, played against type by Glenn Ford, to catch the 310 train to Yuma so that Mr. Ford can be put to trial. Meanwhile, Ben's gang is on the prowl, ready to shoot up entire towns to keep their leader out of jail. This film is number 657 in the Criterion Collection.
Ooh.
And I chose this film because I love Westerns. They are a uniquely American art form that have impacted cinema cultures around the world. And I feel that the more that Crit Club reviews these films, the more that we'll understand ourselves as Americans. So, my Crit Clubbers, are you ready to take that train? Looking forward to
all
hearing
aboard.
What you have to say. All aboard.
Come on, ride that train.
I am going to start with Peter.
Yeah, I was going to raise my hand because I've got the tagline here. I wrote it out. I'm going to read it straight from my notes.
Okay.
Men will walk Ben Wade to the train station instead of going to therapy.
I like that.
I see.
Thank you. No, but also I fucking love this movie. But also I thought this was great. Like also I can't put my finger on why it felt unmistakably Elmore Leonard, but it did feel unmistakably Elmore Leonard. Like I said at last week's episode, I went through a big spree last year and read only like four or five of his books, which is nothing in his whole thing. But it like was enough for me to sort of understand the like heavy gray shading that he adds to characters and these like specific types of situations that that are like maybe less obvious than you would think from a typical Western or a typical action movie. I thought these characters in this situation was incredibly watchable and incredibly entertaining. Like I didn't think that there was necessarily anything super deep or dense about it, but I also don't think there was like supposed to be. Like I think this is like a pretty straightforward story around, I don't know, life and temptation and situations and, you know, what's the fucking name of the I wrote it down too. Contention.
Mm-hmm.
The Contention City. Wow. And I also thought, I don't know. I just thought it was like kind of amazing, like not amazing. I don't know. I'm going to think about it as I walk through it, but like just kind of like super, super great. Like I thought the acting was like stellar. I thought the directing and all of the shots were really evocative. Like I went as soon as it ended for me, I went to try to watch some of Johnny Guitar again, which I famously did not exactly love. But I couldn't help sort of, which we watched in a couple of weeks, or I guess a couple of months ago now, but just how different this movie felt than that one in a way that this movie and all of its like patience and all of its sort of like quiet, like confidence, like it took its time in so many ways. And also just like had a lot of feeling of production and place in a way that I did not find in Johnny Guitar. I don't know. I mean, there's lots I could say and lots I want to hear about in terms of sort of the overall man pride thing around it. But as its story, I thought it was like fucking kind of great. And I'm really excited to hear what you all think as well.
Thank you, Peter. I was really particularly excited because I know you'd read some of Elmer Leonard's work. Mm-hmm. We happened to dig up the short story, which is available for free on Amazon, which we might be able to link to in our show notes.
Yeah, I'll link that in there. That's a good
because,
call.
Because I read a bit of the short story, not to get too far into this, but really great opportunity to understand the difference between a short story and a screenplay. But before I get too deeply into that, I would love to hear what Corey thinks of The 310 to Yuma.
I also liked it as well. I was also thinking a lot of Johnny Guitar. I don't have a ton of experience with like the Western genre. I will say I love those like spaghetti Westerns, like Good, Bad, the Ugly and Fistful of Dollars. Like those are some like mind-blowingly amazing movies, like just absolutely brimming with creativity. And I was, but beyond that and like watching, I guess, Tombstone when I was a teenager or something like that. And then like Johnny Guitar for this, like I've not watched a lot of Westerns, but then like sort of reflecting on it, this almost doesn't even feel like a Western. I mean, it is.
Oh, interesting.
It's like set in the Old West, and like it wouldn't be a story without all of the sort of things about the Old West, the, you know, the railroads and the shootouts and the people taking law into their own hand. Like all that is there, but like this is not what I would think of as a standard, you know, stereotypical Western, which is what I thought I was getting into. What we actually got into is, like you were saying, like it's this like slower paced, like psychological, like it felt like you were really and you immediately start feeling like the shades of gray, like as soon as like the bad guy is like super polite and all that stuff, I'm like, oh, you're gonna throw a bunch of shades of gray on this, aren't you? You're gonna make, because like I think another big trope, or at least like the sort of stereotype of Westerns, is that like it's black and white. These are the good guys, these are the bad guys, and like that's not what this is here. And I really appreciated that. I appreciated the various characters throughout all this. I didn't like 100% like love it or anything like that, because at the end of the day it was like a little slow paced for something that I would watch, but I definitely like appreciated it. And especially compared to like Johnny Guitar, this is a gorgeous movie. Like I felt like a lot of like stuff in Johnny Guitar was very just like flat, boring, and like a stage play or whatever. And
agreed.
This had a lot of just really cool shots and cinematography, and they were like
totally agree
moving you through this. And I don't know, it was definitely an enjoyable film. So I definitely enjoyed watching it. And this is also another example of something that I would not have picked out on my own. So I'm once again glad for Ye Olde Crit Club to help push me and expand my own boundaries.
Ye Olde
Crit Club. Or it's the Old West.
Put it on my tombstone, baby.
Wizard, how
Hello.
Did you enjoy your ride on the 310 to Yuma?
Yahoo! It was a great time. This was a great movie. It is a slow burn, and I was not expecting a slow burn. I'm not really sure what I was expecting, to be honest. I'm familiar with like the plot. And I did not ever see the James Mangold remake that I hear is pretty good. Mm-hmm. Seeing this was just fun. I think in the time they made this movie, they would have said it was crackerjack. It really just like it has these slow moments of like men talking about stuff and staring into the middle distance, working out their stuff, and then these really well done action scenes, and really like intense, like there's like an intensity to the film that I wasn't expecting. When they, spoilers everybody, when they hang the town drunk in the lobby of the hotel, that's, my jaw dropped. I was like, because like I was fully expecting something like that, but emotionally it just was such a like grim, like earned moment. I was like, oh damn, that's harsh, they killed my boy Alex, fuck. and the whole movie is like that, and I loved the sort of like the anti-hero, anti-heel turn from Glenn Ford, who I think just did such a great job of just being this like charming ass like bandit cowboy guy. I found his character like captivating, and just like his ease in every scene, like just cause a man like on vacation, like just relaxed and not worried about anything.
Just grinning Cheshire cat guy the whole time.
Yeah. And then at the end, he's like, well, don't worry about it. I've broken out of Yuma before. And you're like, oh, like, this, you're great, man. You're great. Anyways, it was a great movie. I had a great time. I loved the, we can talk, well, obviously, I think we'll talk a little bit more, but the ending, both in terms of what happens with our anti-hero and just like the scene, like the joy in the ending when it finally begins to rain. It's just like, I was like, well done. You guys earned every emotional beat.
I guess. I had a little bit of issues with some of the ending, but we'll get to it.
I have a lot of thoughts. I'm really excited to talk about the ending.
Angela, what did you think of 310 to Yuma?
All aboard, Angela.
Oh, I'm a riding that train. Mm. Not doing any cocaine, but definitely riding that train. It was, like I loved it.
That's a
no, I'm making a bad Grateful Dead joke.
Grateful Dead joke.
Anyway, it was great because it felt, even though it was intense and dramatic, it felt natural. It didn't feel like something was sitting on me. I didn't get overwhelmed by the drama that was happening. But also, like, in every moment, I was entertained. I wasn't looking at my watch or my phone going, gee, when is this going to be over? I was pretty riveted and loved just how quickly they were able to get this story rolling on that track. Mm-hmm. I mean, what, within not even 3 minutes, you know, they had conflict and tension and characters, right? Mm-hmm. And so that made me hook in and care about every character, good or bad. And the cinematography is exquisite. If you want to really understand high key black and white cinematography that is done in the freaking, like, you know, the light of day, watch this movie, because it ain't easy. Because there's so much light, you have to work really hard to get those hard shadows. So I thought it was delicious. It made me relate to the older men in my life who loved Western films, right? You know that feeling you were talking about, like, of, you know, the men working on their shit, looking in the middle distance. Like, this is why men love Westerns, right? This is a place where they can silently and without actually talking to anyone commiserate about, you know, their masculinity life.
It's crazy. It's like camping. Right. You can just kind of go, yep.
Stare it in the fire.
Yeah. No. And I think actually men need that. Don't necessarily want to, you know, be actively processing something. Sometimes they just want to watch cowboys and Indians and outlaws and cops fight it out for them, so that they can just sort of, everything else looks easy in comparison, perhaps. I don't know. I'm generalizing for sure and making sweeping assumptions. But
no, tell me what men want.
Well, maybe later. Anywho, I just adored this movie. I loved the psychological drama of it and the play between the two main characters, you know, of one really trying to get the other one to accede to his desires, showing that they both actually have a lot in common. I found that just absolutely delicious, especially the hotel room scenes where...
so good.
My God. The gun, the window, the people outside who can see the robber. What's interesting is that Glenn Ford was actually offered the main role of the cattle rancher, and he was he was typical. That is like... that would be the role he normally played. Mm-hmm. But he was like, no, I want this villain role. And he just ate the scenery.
It's meaty. It's a meaty role.
It's a meaty role. And I couldn't take my eyes off of him. He did it well. Mm-hmm. And he had that, like, that simultaneously, like, grown up but baby face a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, those rounded cheeks and stuff, like, and big eyes.
It's like an innocent looking guy, right? You're like, this guy seems okay.
Yeah.
He's a charmer.
And I also loved the kids in the movie kind of like saying what we're all thinking.
Oh,
but then they say that, though, it creates a sense of danger, because you know that this bad guy is dangerous. So I loved how deftly the screenplay handled all of these things. I also love it just as an example, having read, I only read half of the short story because I didn't have enough time today, but I understand just how much the screenwriter has to flesh out an entire world and find actions and scenes that convey the same messages that are going on in a short story. And it's hard work. And I'm just really blown away by the screenwriters who did this. I'm excited that we all are at least invigorated by this film and have lots of things to talk about. So thank you all for watching. Sure which direction to take this in now.
Well,
help
let's,
me out.
We got to start off with the bespoke musical number that opens.
Yes. Which I honestly loved. Same. Which I thought was like really good.
Yeah. I mean, Orville Peck to cover it so badly.
It made me a little worried because I was like, oh God. How much hokiness is there going to be in this?
You guys didn't say it would be a singing movie.
Yeah. Well, because, I mean, like, one of the things that I worry about with, like, Westerns and stuff that, like, would give me a hard time getting into it is, like, too much hokiness. I'm expecting a little bit. And so
Paint Your Wagon. Corey thought this was...
exactly.
Paint Your Wagon.
Yeah.
Or Johnny Guitar, honestly.
Yeah.
Guys, I really don't see... what can be what we could achieve. Johnny Guitar is a stone cold classic.
Yeah.
It's got a musical now, so yeah.
But I really enjoyed that song because I had the same thought. My first thought was, oh, this is the intro that Corey hates because it did all the credits at first. And then I was kind of using my time to do a little dishes while it did its thing. Mm-hmm. But I was like, I kept being like, oh, mm-hmm. this song, oh. That song's not bad.
Yeah, it at least has its own.
Surprisingly won over.
Yeah, it at least has its own song and some fun font work that made it a little more interesting than normal.
I don't know if anybody else watched anything. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just realized that I'm going to think about how much Corey hates lengthy opening credits, like until I die, probably. I'm going to be like, oh, Corey would not like this. Corey would not like this.
But, I watched, there was only one sort of featurette. I think maybe there were two featurettes actually on the Criterion channel about this movie. Mm-hmm. And I watched the one of the interview with Elmore Leonard mm-hmm. about this movie. I'm not sure if anybody else
no.
did. But he picked up the fact, which I sort of noticed, but I didn't exactly fully notice, I guess, is that Ben Wade, Glenn Ford's character, is like whistling or humming the theme throughout
yeah,
occasionally,
yeah, yeah.
which I also kind of think is great.
That's cute. Like, nice
he
callbacks.
Knows he's in the movie.
But let me talk. Like I did a bit of a disservice when I said this movie isn't exactly deep or dense. I actually do think it wrestles with some fascinating sort of, I don't know, tenets, morals, ethics, underlying sort of mm-hmm. concepts of people. And I think the way it does that and kind of like immediately and I think masterfully exhibits that is you have the holdup. Ben Wade's gang robs the stagecoach and the stagecoach driver thinks he's going to get one over on them and takes one of the men hostage. And mm-hmm. Ben Wade shoots both of them dead. Mm-hmm. I think that is such an incredibly illustrative point about who this character is.
Yep.
And it wasn't like it just in the next several scenes, I'm like, oh, but they're also kind of giving him the hero's treatment and this like bartender gal and everything. Like, I think it set up so much of, again, that gray area that, but also I felt all of it was earned. Like, I felt all of it was like believable and grounded in the situations that they are around. I don't know. I just wanted to start there because I kept thinking about like just him shooting his own man and the man who tried to take him hostage as this really strikingly definitive character trait that mm-hmm. sticks with you and that character through the entire film.
Especially in the context of the rest of the scene, like it's very calm, like everybody, like, mm-hmm. like we learned, as you say, we learn a lot about this guy. We learn that he's like very calm. He's very like cool under pressure. And when things go like askew, immediately dealt with in like the yeah. most brutal, like violent way possible, which is such a crazy dynamic to set up, especially like knowing the context of the film, like it immediately says, this is some dangerous shit. This is like, these are big stakes. Every one of these guys is like a hardened murderer, and that's super. These are our antagonists for the film.
It's also interesting that his his men would be so loyal to him if he were so, you know, sort of cavalier about just, shooting one of his own. But they're incredibly loyal, as we find out.
Yeah.
Well, I find it interesting, like, that they do a lot up front to establish who these two different men are, the rancher and the gang leader. And I really appreciated that they did spend so much time with the gang leader, kind of having that emotional rapport with that bartender lady who he ostensibly takes into another room.
So they had a little bit more going on than an emotional rapport.
Oh, yeah. Like, he was super smooth. It was very impressive. And it makes you almost root for that character, right? And that's in a strong contrast to the rancher, who's like a family man, right? Mm-hmm. And it's almost as if the film is saying that these are almost two legitimate paths aside from the murder, right? Or are they completely exclusive? Like the rancher is almost like, in comparison, well, he's got the wife, I guess. I don't know. But it makes you pull for both of them, even though this guy has shot two people, one of his own guys, at the blink of an eye.
Go ahead. I feel like maybe I've seen too many Clint Eastwood movies, too much like Elegy for the Western type stuff, but I thought the movie was implying that the rancher has some, like, back in the day, like, sinister stuff going on. Like, I got a sense of him as, like, a guy who, like, had some wild days, and then he's not really... Not like he doesn't do that anymore because he has kids and he has a family and that kind of stuff. And again,
like,
I can't
imply that he's like a really good shot and that he has ostensibly killed a lot of people and stuff like that.
And I think the choice of actor, like, this dude, he just seems very hardened in a way that a less, maybe if you weren't trying to, like, send some of that like reformed bad guy energy, you would have picked like a fresher faced guy to be your rancher, you know, like a younger, more heroic type. I don't know. I feel like maybe that's just so that these two men appear like equals when they're in scenes and stuff like that. But I couldn't shake this like feeling that, like, oh, there's a story to this, to Dan, who's his name, that this movie is pointing to but not telling us about.
And I think I think that in comparison to the like the Ben scene in the bar with the bartender and stuff is when, like, I started realizing that this is not sort of the normal setup for things. I mean, in a normal, like, Western, you would have
your white hat
guy going in and being the charmer and, you know, having the love interest and all that stuff, but instead you're giving that to the who's ostensibly supposed to be the villain and stuff here. So yeah, and then having this, like, scraggly face guy as the sort of main lead and stuff. It's like, oh, they're playing with these conventions that were probably, you know, sort of stale and stereotyped by the time this movie was even made.
Well, before we get too much away from the opening, because there are two things that actually happen in there, and I think I can't remember if it was Angela, if you said this about, like, the decision maker, maybe it was Wizard who said, like, you know, Ben may be in a decision maker. Like, there are two things that happen. There's the Ben Wade shooting his man and the stagecoach driver, and there are these fucking kids calling their dad.
Hey, Dad, go get yourself killed, Dad. What are you doing?
But which I thought was funny, as in, like, fuck these kids. These kids don't know shit. But also, like, that, like, but also I did feel like it underscores, and I think, again, does a masterful job of setting up the, like, underlying main theme of the movie of to act or not to act.
Right.
Like, and what that entails.
He has an inability to act. And it's also showing how much his kids do look up to him and stuff, too.
Yeah.
Like, to almost think that he is bulletproof.
I hated them.
No, I know. I wanted to.
It was so funny.
Little kid.
I don't think there's been a tolerable child actor in filmmaking until, like, Linda.
Hey, man,
Blair,
I just watched a whole bunch of Jodie Foster movies, and she was pretty good.
I thought 400 Blows Kid was great.
Oh, yeah, brooding kid. He broods. He brood so good. So bien.
He brood good. All right, what's next?
So what do we got? We stumble across a stagecoach robbery. Ben Wade takes their horses, but he says, "I'll let them loose once we get ready to leave town." So we know again he's like a good guy. He doesn't steal their horses. He says, "I'm gonna borrow your car for a little while, so you can't go to the marshals and such."
Yeah.
And then they go back. I do love that scene of them all commiserating and drinking the dead guy, and that sort of like comitatus understanding that, you know, it was better that he died, I guess. I don't know. There's a real sort of like soft feeling around that like you kind of see where they're going, but also maybe it's fear that has them agreeing with it. And then I did enjoy them being the ones to like tell them all about the stagecoach and like, y'all should go out there and take care of it. That felt very Elmore Leonard. That felt like a real sly thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then they leave and Ben Wade gets some.
The whole scene with the guys in there and her just pouring the drinks, it's just a super horny scene. And I was getting uncomfortable.
I don't know, it was kind of I really enjoyed how like watching her pour individually each of those shots, like going down and then back up, like that she is essentially at their mercy, and for her to keep them occupied by continually pouring their drinks was a smart move. Like I was immediately in fear for her, like because there are all these men and the sheriff is asleep napping and she even admits as such. I would not have had the ovaries to do that. And you know, yet I am curious as to whether she remembers that guy. Like, you know how they talk and Ben Wade is
like
talking
to her.
Knew her from another place. Yeah. And it would have been interesting to see a greater hint as to whether or not she actually remembered him. Like that would have, but then it would have eliminated the tension of, you know, her versus what, 10 of these guys, which was freaky deaky for me, but she held her own. She was a really amazing actress. I really enjoyed that
all
scene.
All before flair bartending, you know?
Yeah.
You gotta like pour into each individual shot glass, just line them up, pour it down.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Yeah.
Or have more than one drink.
This is the old West. There is one drink and it's
there's
brown.
Whiskey. Yeah.
As soon as this movie started, I was just like, I would hate living in the old West. Good God, I would like, we just moved to the suburbs and I don't even like it out here. Like, it's just like, I would have hated that. Like, I would have done everything I could to get out of there. Not my lifestyle.
Corey, I know for a fact that you like dusty, warm whiskey. I've seen you.
Well, that's true. Okay. But I want a vacation there. I don't want to live there.
But this was the scene, or around this was the scene. There's like, very specifically, it was when Wade and the bartender, what is her name?
Bartender, I don't know. I did notice, though, that like the other two main characters both had extremely similar sounding names. There was Alice and Alex.
Yeah.
Actually, there was a couple, pieces of dialogue where I was like, wait, who did they say, Alice or Alex? They're very similar names.
But it was like when they're talking outside and she kind of slowly goes in the door and he gets off and decide to walk back in there. Like, I guess that's when that hit me. I mentioned it in my opening of the patience of this movie. Like, that's when it really hit me. And I've said it, I don't know how many times in the show, I just fucking love, like, there's something confident about like, there's no hurry. There's no rush. I'm just going to walk across these boards and this movie's going to let this guy, like, again, this was a tight hour and a half that we had with this movie.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Still it felt like, I can't believe how it felt so patient and confident in these times of just like, yeah, we're just going to show this guy like slowly stepping, slowly entering, slowly walking up, slowly talking. I don't know. That really I don't know how to say it. And I'm sure there are many people have written it a lot better, but spending that amount of like quiet time with a character, it doesn't necessarily make me root for them, but it makes me like feel more comfortable and more like interested in what they do next or who they are, I guess, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there's the whole caper They well, I guess, you know, a bunch of stuff happened. I don't know how granular they were. We want to get, but I want to, like, so they run back. He's busy, you know, having some sex, and they catch him, and then, like, the gang is going to come back to get him, and then there's that whole, like, caper, which was, like, fun and fine. I'm curious how you all thought about it, of, like, the old switcheroo.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how they were going to know or see which direction of the stagecoach that they would be watched from. I don't know. Mm. Yeah, what did you all think?
I genuinely, you know, I'm the caper is fine because I genuinely found the scenes where Glenn Ford is at their house chilling having dinner
yes.
to be some
yes.
of the most entertaining scenes
yes.
in the movie.
Oh, I loved, like, it so much.
Some of yeah. the best scenes in the movie, some of the best acting. Like, I like when the movie started, I was like, this rancher's wife is going to have such a thankless role in this film, mm-hmm. and she's and it's going to bum me out at the end of it. And she has these wonderful scenes with Glenn Ford at their home. Like, they have dinner, they chat. Again, he's very charming, and, like, I loved this excuse, I guess. I love this excuse to bring this part of the story, these two parts of the story together. You know what I mean?
Well, it's awesome because that woman, I mean, the whole point of those scenes is that this rancher's wife actually has a past, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there is kind of a suggestion, you know, like, it's almost as if he knows her from San Francisco too, but probably yeah. doesn't. It just kind of gets, mm-hmm. he's trying to get under the skin there. And you can tell from her reactions, like, that she has a story, even if she can't tell it all in at this moment. She just seems like a richer and more dynamic character. And they don't have to do a whole lot with it. She clearly has goals of her own to protect her family. And it was interesting where, like, the boys are like, you didn't say grace, mom. You know, they are like, you know, the kids are often the ones that make you, you know, abide by the rules more than anyone else.
Mm-hmm. And there's that, like, you know, like, classic, like, good and evil stuff. Like, oh, do we not say grace because there's, like, an evil man at the table? Or is grace not for him? Because
he's bad.
Oh, my God. Like,
no, I'm just so distracted by how handsome he is.
He's shoot him now, pa.
So yeah, right? His meaty, manly face just does things to me.
One of my things about this movie is that there's, like, not a ton of humor in it, and I feel like I was hoping for a little more, and I think that would have, like, perked it up a little bit. But there is the one scene where it's like Alex is asking for, like, hey, your dad have a jug or whatever around? And he's like, yeah. No, I don't. He's like, yeah, dad said you'd ask for that. Just like, I thought that was really funny.
That was funny.
Another line that, like, felt very Elmore Leonard. I don't know. Maybe I'm not the expert on this, but that, like, exactly
that
seemed
funny.
And so they get to Contention City.
Yeah, well, so I guess I'm wondering, like, did anybody sleep? And how long is this? Like, this has to be, like, freaking exhausting just doing this whole ordeal.
Well, that's, like, kind of hinted at when they get when they finally get to the hotel room. Like, Ben Wade is saying, you've been up all night,
right.
Aren't you tired? Yeah, like, so it feels like
I'll hold the gun for you. You can just take
right.
a nap.
Yeah. And I will say they did film this in, like, the locations that it shot in. Like, I guess that really is what Contention City looks like, and that's where they shot this.
There is a Contention City that felt like a supremely made up name.
Mm. No, apparently not.
I guess
I guess all names are made up, but
well, interestingly,
oh, yeah, I guess so. In Arizona, yeah, looking right there,
Bisbee,
yeah.
Arizona. My husband's uncle lives there, and his aunt actually just died in Bisbee this week. And so I thought it was a bizarre coincidence when I'm watching this movie, and it's in Bisbee, Arizona. So thinking of Kathy Helmick this week, just as an aside.
Man, this looks, yeah, this is at the very bottom of that Arizona state. Wow, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Hot.
And actually, interestingly, it is fertile. Like, some of the hills in eastern Arizona, you can grow stuff, and there are farmers out there.
All you got to do to make it rain is get on the train with a bad guy.
That's true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We should just send all of our bad guys there.
Did you all, did anyone else immediately clock that the sleeping guy was one of his group?
Noah did. Yeah. I was watching Noah, and they're like, that's a bad guy.
Yeah. That guy sure loves to sleep.
Yeah, right.
But I didn't expect the guy to actually be sleeping. That surprised me. As he kind of like gets up and like is acting like he's been, I was like, oh, was he actually sleeping?
Chekhov's snoozing gangster.
That's funny.
I want to ask you all about like, so during this time and as it, especially as they get to Contention City and there's this sort of run up, what you all thought about tension in this movie. I think there's like a comparison, not exactly, because they're different movies and they're trying to say sell different things, but like I guess I thought a little bit of Wages of Fear and like this like these sort of tightening taut lines, and again I don't think this movie was trying to put you in the same crazy neurotic position that Wages of Fear was, but like you're feeling like the fuse, like you're seeing the fuse go down on the bomb, you know, and I felt like I really felt like this movie did a great job of like ramping up that tension more and more. I'm curious what you all thought.
Well, speaking of ramping up tension, we did miss one important plot point,
please.
Which I think is very important, and that's that the brother of the man who was murdered by Ben Wade, he discovers that Ben Wade is in town, and he shows up ready to get some vigilante justice on. And this is like one of the first real challenges that our intrepid rancher faces, like. Where it's like one of those situations where like he does need the money, but he could wash his hands of this whole like increasingly dangerous situation by just letting this guy whack a gangster and walk away. Say it was that guy who took care of it, you know.
That's so true. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way.
But is it about money? Is it about justice? Like, this is one of the things that the movie's kind of like playing around with. But I just thought, like, even that scene, like, we get this, like, spike in tension where it kind of seems like everything will just kind of resolve itself in a nice, neat little package. And it doesn't work out like that.
It just seems that these two characters who seem, like, on the surface to be opposed, they actually have similar values, right? But they are acted out in different ways. Like the rancher guy, his name is Dan. Yeah.
Dan.
Like he intervenes when the brother comes along of the guy who was killed and tries to kill Ben Wade. And he like stops that from happening, which is an important plot point. But there's an efficiency to that. There's like an adherence to doing the right thing. But then for Ben Wade, you know, he was also doing the right thing for him to shoot both the hostage and the stagecoach driver. So even though they seem like opposites, because they're both like one is kind of working for evil, one is working for good. Both guys are still doing what they need to do to meet their objectives. And I don't know if that makes sense, if it's too abstract, but that whole scene with the brother kind of made those two seem like bigger equals to me rather than directly opposed. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little long-winded.
They both want to keep him alive. Yeah. They both want to keep him alive.
Yeah, they're both very invested in all this working out, you know? Okay.
It was something I thought a lot about during, I've already forgotten his name. I don't know how many times Dan Evans is said, but it doesn't feel like it's said a lot.
Probably not a lot.
Yeah. but I did like wonder about his motivations through all of this. You know, like it did seem a lot of it was kids. I can't tell my kids. but also just that. Instead of going to therapy part. But I like it's fascinating. I didn't consider him having history and a past and things, but I think you all are right. They definitely sort of set that up, and that makes this a much... I didn't think it was a thin character, but it makes him fuller to consider that. I enjoy that reading.
I thought that they were going to kill off Butterfield so that he wasn't even going to get the money anyway. And so then he had to choose to do
smart.
It.
Ending.
Smart.
That's and then, an and then when his wife comes, I thought that they were gonna, you know, sort of use his wife as ransom collateral, something or other. But that ended up not happening.
Either. I was yelling at the TV about that. I was like, I was not happy with the wife. Like, I was like, are you really trying to put yourself and your whole family in danger? Like, that just seemed like a bad idea.
Yeah.
But I want to make sure. Like, Peter had a really good question, and I can't remember what the question was, and I want to make sure we answered it.
About what?
I don't know. You said, I had a question before we talked about the brother.
Talk about tension?
Yes.
Talk about the, like, how it stepped up tension and how it sort of created that. I'm curious if other people felt that and how they felt it.
Yeah. Do you feel like we answered that?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I don't know.
Okay, good. I just wanted to make sure it was a good question.
I'm just throwing shit out there to get conversation, keep conversations moving.
The hotel stuff reminded me a lot of one of my all-time favorite movies, No Country for Old Men. And I'm sure that, like, Cormac McCarthy is a huge fan of, you know, this movie and Elmore Leonard and all that. I don't know. That just really made me think of it, especially just the setting and all that stuff. And it reminded me of a lot of, like, the really tense conversations that were happening and stuff in that movie too.
Yeah, I love that situation. I mean, to me, this movie, my memory of this movie will probably just be that hotel room, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, to me, that just seems like the hallmark big, huge thing about this movie, because it felt to me like such a unique setting, such a unique situation. Like, and I felt like the instances and the conversations and the attitudes that are presented, blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't know, just it's super memorable and super engaging. Yeah. Like, I was like, this is great. I'm here. I'm like watching
in a hotel room waiting for a train to come.
Like, I know. You wouldn't think that it would be so engaging, but it is.
And also, And then I think it's even taken up another level, because here is where, well, there are many places where the cinematography shined. But Angela, you talking about how well they did with black and white, like the inside outside shots, like how they're framing these men on the roofs, and how they're sort of like having those perspective views of the outside and inside, and keeping all that lighting as sharp, keeping all the picture as sharp as it is. It's just really like, pardon me, everyone, listeners, I'm so sorry. I don't really like myself either. But the mise en scène that is created in various parts through this mise en scène is just like exceptional.
I mean, and also I want you guys to remember that in this time that we didn't have digital cameras, right? You didn't see what you see is what you get in a camera, right?
Yeah.
You had to physically measure your objects from distance from the camera, and you wouldn't know until you got the rushes the next day whether or not you nailed your shot. And every single shot in this film is exquisite and perfect.
They really nail the shots, yeah.
And so this wasn't an easy thing, especially because of just how much light. You have to pick the right film stock. You have to have your aperture at the right opening. You have to have your focus ring. And this is all done manually. And sometimes they still shoot this way, but you still, even now, at this point, you can still see you get a digital shot that reflects how you've set up your cameras. So it was incredibly difficult for them to do this right and well. And I forget who they did. I should look it up. But I was blown away by all of that.
Should we talk about the ending?
I was surprised, but I thought this was going to end a lot more badly.
Thought this would be a grim one? Thought this would be a grim one?
Oh, yeah.
Ending.
Well,
I want to hear Corey's.
Yeah.
So you sort of like, it sort of like cascades into like act three, where basically like Ben is just like calling all the shots. He's like telling everyone what to do, like, which is so funny, like that he's the guy in chains, but he's like basically telling, why don't you go look out the window? Why don't you go do that?
So good.
And then he's like, you know, Butterfield's going to ditch you. He's not going to like stand by. And then five minutes later, he's ditching them. And stuff like that. Like, I don't know. It's just like really good. And so like they do set him up as this like extremely like cocksure kind of, you know, guy or whatever. And I don't want to like skip right to the very end, but like, help me work through this, because there are so many times where he's being led through town, like at gunpoint. And I was just like, just lay down. Like, he can't drag you physically to the, we already know he's not going to shoot you. He's not going to drag you physically you know, train station. Lay down and get rested.
Hero, everyone. Dead weight.
That's funny.
No, the point is, like, in terms of this tome of what is it to be a masculine man in America, is that, you finish what you set out to do.
Right.
Right.
Which is also, like, the line. Don't think he's not keeping that gang if he just lays down and throws a tantrum.
Yeah. And he's like, I don't like owing anyone anything or whatever, because I guess he saved his life from the guy or whatever. Yeah. It's like,
I had a hard time believing it, but.
I had a hard time believing it.
It was almost anticlimactic for me. Like, and I was like, oh, wait, that's it? I wanted there to be like another confrontation. Oh. At Yuma. Do you know what I'm saying?
I wish they would have... Go ahead.
But because it's an Elmore Leonard story, I was like, you know what? This makes sense to me because this is your perfect in media res, like the cinematic circus thing. We are only seeing a snapshot of this whole story. And Hollywood likes to have everything wrapped up in a tidy bow. But I loved at the end, even though I was initially kind of like, I don't know about this ending. It's a little meh. But as the camera is pulling away from the train as it's moving, I'm like, actually, I'm okay with this. It suggests the imperfection, the ambiguity that life in itself has. Like that life rarely actually gives you a pat ending. And so I get what you're saying. I was feeling that level of dissatisfaction, but it resolved.
I wish they would have set it up a little or something. Like they would have offered him the stew at the home and he's like refusing to eat. It's like, no, I'm not going to eat. I don't like being in anyone's debt. I don't like owing anyone anything. And maybe they will like convince him and cajole him to do it or whatever. It's like, okay. Like they could have like set it up a little bit.
Wait, what's the problem, Corey? Like what's the signature action that you think wasn't set up? Like of him jumping on the train with the guy of them, like them both jumping on the train
and
together?
Just like even like going along with it. Like at this point, we're just down to Dan with a shotgun. We are already established that Dan is not going to shoot him in the back. Like he's not going to do it. So it's like he could have it. This whole thing where I like where he used the horses, the, you know, the body shield and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But like he could have, I was screaming like, you can get away. You can either like just lay down, stop, don't do anything, and like have your guys come rush him, or like you could probably just walk away from him at this point and he's not going to shoot you. Like, so then him getting on the thing and I'm like, oh, is that how they're kind of like backwards justifying it? I'm like, is that his motivation? I don't know, just maybe like have to like do a like mental gymnastics to sort of like catch up with where he was mentally, because I was not brought along board with it. He was just going to go anyway because he doesn't like owing anybody anything. It just came like out of nowhere.
No,
can I share my perspective?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. That was my experience with it.
I have another thing to say, but go for it. Go for it, Peter.
No, because like, because I was kind of thinking this because I'm now more set than ever on this one, and I'm so excited. Because it also okay, like this is a man brimming with confidence that is just nothing but sure of everything, whether that's real or not, or like Ben Wade is, whether that's mm-hmm. going to come to fruition or not. And I like completely bought the walking through town because what's going to happen to him? Like think of all of the movements that his whole gang has been doing just because of him in the lead up to, like, they're not going to let him down, at least for his thinking. If you know they're not going to get to the finish line and not cross the finish line, but for me, the culminating single moment that happened here for me, as I saw it, was that face off as the steam is around them, and you know I fucking forgot his goddamn name again, Dan.
He said it all Dan, the time. Ben was always saying like, "Why don't you go look out the window, Dan?
You're right,
why don't you give me the gun,
right.
Dan?"
I'm bad with names. I'm bad with names. But when Dan has him, when Dan is holding him hostage, and maybe I'm projecting, maybe I'm completely misreading it, but on Ben Wade Glenford's face, I saw him recognize the exact same position of his own man at the beginning of the movie being held hostage and thinking that he taught his boys to shoot your man, even if he's the hostage, to get through. Like, that is precisely what I thought. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm making this up, but in Glenford's face, I saw his confidence falter, him double think all of his confidence and making a quick decision and action again, that the safest way to get out of all of this is to just jump on there with him.
Agreed.
He's broken out of Yuma before. This is my reading, and I actually feel very confident about my reading, for me personally.
Because that's how I thought after. I was like, why? What is it about this? How does this actually make sense to me? And I realized that the way that these guys could have shot, like started shooting at Dan, that Ben could have also gotten shot too. And so he realized that he was in as much
danger. Why wouldn't they just shoot him?
Exactly.
Yeah. But also, right? Like, it's completely parallel to the beginning.
Yeah.
Like, I actually
totally.
Feel, maybe I feel pretty confident about this. This is a paralleled, you know, situation from the beginning.
But why would they even bother to come try to rescue him?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not saying that, like, they were going to shoot all of them. I'm saying that, like...
Well, the suggestion is that those guys are not, there are no leaders in that group. They're only sheep because they didn't shoot.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, that's my thought. Like, I could be making it up, but I really felt like I read that in Glenn Ford's acting of like, maybe this was a bad idea. Maybe I should just jump on that train with this guy. I've broken out of Yuma before. And like, I don't know. I kind of fucking love this ending with that. I don't know.
You're really onto the 310 to Yuma with this one, Peter. I'm on board. I'm on board with your reading of it.
I feel like the parallel with the beginning is too stark for it to not play a part in sort of the character motivations. And so I love the ending. The rain made me like,
I was like, ah,
groan.
Well, it's like
I knew it was.
We're bookending with Hokie. Like we have the Hokie song at the beginning, and then we have the Hokie rain at the end. But the rest of it was like, not that Hokie.
More it like the whole like third act of the film, like it's so great. They're like, oh, there's thunder coming, like weather parallels with rising action, like the moment the story like breaks, the rain breaks, it's perfect. Like sometimes a lack of subtlety is just the thing that you want, and like there's so much like catharsis in that moment of like two dads riding the train together, they've reached a manly understanding, and then it rains and you're just like, fuck yeah.
That is nature.
Yeah. I didn't mind it. Like I did as soon at the very beginning. I was like, oh, it's gonna rain. By the end of this movie, you're gonna rain. But I groaned a little bit, but I
deluge, if you will.
It's gonna rain in southern Arizona. Don't worry, Betsy. I moved us out here where it always rains.
So
Arizona listeners, what's the precipitation like? Hit us up. Yeah. Give us millimeters per minute, or I don't know.
I'm gonna give you all a Contention City update according to Wikipedia right now. It is a ghost town. Ghost town.
Corey, is that what you meant by you wanting there to be more humor in the film? Did you want at least just one character to come up and say, well, hell, I'm a caricature?
No,
I have a candy gram for Ben Wade.
Oh, hell.
So, everybody, where are we at? Funny. Do we have any residual thoughts, things that we should discuss before we start rolling?
Shout out to the stuntmen of this film. There
fuck
is
yes, the falling off that the roof. There,
mm-hmm. When Dan shoots the guy on the roof and he falls three stories like a friggin' pinball, like rolls off of one building onto the awning of another, onto the ground, all one take, all one shot. Shout out. That must have hurt.
Give Oscars to stunt people.
Oscars to stunt people.
I'd also say some of these actors really knew how to ride horses. Like they were just jumping on, jumping off, like doing.
I don't want to belabor this point. We're going over anyway, but I don't know if we should talk about Johnny Guitar. I don't know. I don't know what else there to say. I just really
felt it's a different movie. It's a different kind of western.
It's a different kind of western. Mm-hmm. That's fine, but God, whatever.
Yeah, and again, I don't really. Yes, this is a. I feel like this is a movie set in the Old West.
And so I'm curious about this, Corey. You said, but like, what is the difference? Is like, I'm curious, like, what you expect a Western to be? Did you like? Did what Johnny Guitar? Is that like what you expect Westerns to be?
Yes, more okay. like that. Yeah. But yeah, it's when you start putting like the shades of gray, and like it's not really about like bravado or just constant shootouts. I mean, it had some of that or whatever, but like, I don't know this. You could easily adapt this into other contexts pretty easily, I think. I mean, I don't know.
I would say that 310 to Yuma is more of a signature Western than Johnny Guitar. Like when
I would agree with that.
Think of 310 to Yuma, I also think about Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood, which if you haven't seen, Corey, you should watch. It's one of the best American movies, period. You mentioned Tombstone. That is one of my favorite movies. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably going to watch it again. That's a great idea. Why didn't I think of that sooner?
I don't know what I'm talking about.
But I think we should keep watching Westerns. This is
hell fucking yeah. Have you, I mean, like, has anyone else seen High Noon?
Yes, a long time again. A long time ago.
It's been like 15 years.
Yeah.
Which I think that was like a 1951, 1952.
Yeah.
And I think that's, that has a lot of similarities with this one, but I definitely think this one is a much better movie.
Yeah.
And also like not nearly as many sort of shades of gray with it. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking a lot about wanting to rewatch High Noon, because I think there's still that like, boy, they love cowboys love keeping time and time in things. Because there's with High Noon, there's still like that ticking time, like the fuse, you're watching the fuse go down before shit's going to get dangerous. But no, I think I'm done. I've said a lot. Thank you all for letting me talk through my piece about the ending. I feel strong about my ending thoughts.
Anybody else?
R.I.P. Alex. You know what? Shot in the back,
yeah.
Strung up in a crummy hotel. He was one of the good ones, and that's important.
Yep. You got to appreciate that, though, for, increasing the drama there and raising the action to make things seem more dangerous. So he played an important role.
Oh, yeah.
But it did both things, I think. It definitely made it feel more dangerous and more everything more risky. But also because Dan, his name is Dan, uses it as an excuse to keep going because the town drunk gave his life for this thing. And that makes sense to me it would feel like, you know, an insult to his memory to not, you know, see this thing through.
This movie is the cinematic equivalent of a man's got to do what a man's got to do.
Jesus, I really enjoyed this movie.
Mm. It was good. Well, it was really good. Really, really good.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that because we're going to roll some ratings here and we do things a little bit differently. We rate on a 1 to 20 scale in honor of the 20-sided die because we're all tabletop roleplay gamers. Before we roll, though, I would like to say that I thought that this, you could reuse this scenario in a campaign if you wanted to. Like, how would your players act if, like, they came across the stagecoach and there was a robbery in action?
Ooh, that's fun.
I was rob the robbers and the stagecoach. Mm-hmm.
the mission, like the quest is to get this one NPC to like this specific time while, you know, the NPC's gang is out there making their own plans.
I'd try to romance somebody. That's just
I would just be drinking. I would just not leave the bar.
Sounds like we will need a fighter, a bard, and a rogue, possibly.
A rogue, yeah.
Yeah, like, or a ranger. We need some, like, and some sort of magic caster, or even a cleric. But that's neither here nor there. We need to roll these ratings. I don't know who I chose at the beginning, but I'm going to start with Corey. Corey, what you rolling here for 310 to Ryuma?
Yeah, I'm feeling a 14 on it. I liked it a lot. It's not a Corey classic or anything like that, but I'm very glad that I watch it. So, yeah, 14.
Very nice.
How many 14s do you have, Corey? Corey, I'm looking through your score sheet. It's, I would say, about half of your scores are 14s here.
Wow.
Put it on his tombstone.
Yeah, Corey. He liked life okay. He gave it a 14.
Hey, do we have averages included on our handy dandy sheet that you can find in your
show notes? No, I have totals of the total like spans of 16 through 20, 11 through 15, 6 through 10. Listeners, you can see in your show notes a spreadsheet that details all of the movies we watch and all of the scores we individually gave them. But not an average. So there's just like a total. Like Corey has 33 11 through 15s.
Okay.
Angela, you have 15.
Breaking like the 14 to 15 barrier is a big one to me because 15 is going into the upper quartile, and this one just barely didn't make it to the upper quartile for me. So
yeah,
fair. Peter, what you rolling on this?
Shit, man, I don't know. Like I was coming in a hot 17, but then I, through my passionate ending talk, I was like, God, is this a fucking 18? I love that ending like a lot, a whole lot.
Don't forget, you have till the end of the show. So
I know,
you know.
I've done that. I've used that before.
Yeah.
And I
be brave.
It's the difference
be
between
bold.
I'm looking at my scores, and I should not do that. I think it's a bad idea for me to look at what.
Oh, absolutely. What do you do? Put that away.
No, it's fun. It's fun. It makes me.
It will be okay.
Something to chide Corey with.
You can chide the rest of us.
You said 14. I was like, that does sound familiar. Fuck, I don't know. I'm going to say 18 for now. I do think this is what it is. I don't think it overstays its welcome. I think it does what it sets out to do exceedingly well. I think it is such a fantastic representation of Westerns at this time, while sort of like being timeless in itself. This doesn't feel like a 50s West. This doesn't feel like a good 50s Western. This feels like a great Western in general. Yeah. And yeah, I'm just going to sit on 18 and see how that feels, because boy, I fucking enjoyed this and really enjoyed talking about it. Thank you.
Wizard, how do you feel about this 14 and this 18? Where are you going to land on this?
You know, for me, it's an easy 17. I really, really enjoyed this movie. It was super fun. It's, you know, Cracker Jack. I'll say it again. I'll say it again, Jack. It's crackers. Strong recommend. 17. Easy peasy.
What about you, Angela?
What do you think, Angela? How are you rolling?
I'm giving it a 19. Like, I was going to stick with 18, but talking about the cinematography,
it's the cinematography.
Oh, it didn't make you cry. It didn't make me cry. It didn't make me cry. And also, the ending did take me out of the moment, so it doesn't get a full 20. And I wasn't going to give it a 19. I was really in 18 territory. But then I was thinking about the cinematography and just how blown away I am by it. And I want to watch like every frame again, just to really nail in some of the extra dynamics in this film, because also there's nighttime shooting, which isn't easy either. They may have shot day for night,
I don't know if I noticed any of that. You can kind of notice that in this era, but I don't think they did that.
Yeah, I think they actually shot at night, which you need incredibly sensitive film, which has huge crystals, which does not get a lot of crispness. And that's, so it's hard to do. Like, this isn't, this was cinematography on hard. Because also, so think about it, you are also dealing, generally speaking, with hotter temperatures, and that can also impact your film because they're shooting on film. So, I'm giving it a 19 because I think this is classic American cinematography that everyone should look at. Beautiful, delicious.
Really, I'm shaking my head really at my 18 that I gave Vagabond because it should be a 19.
So that was cool. 310 to Yuma. And so, of course, you know, we'll be watching something else next week. But what do we do? We always forget. Do we talk about next week's film or do we talk about
next week's film?
Yeah, let's talk next week's film.
Or whatever.
I'm looking at the spreadsheet here. Wizard gave Johnny Guitar a 20.
He did it at the very beginning of the show.
Yeah. Do you like Johnny Guitar more than you like 310 to Yuma?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Those are off.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
I love it.
All right.
I love it.
No, it's a special film. I gave it a high rating.
It's a special movie. Yeah. It's a psychosexual drama set in the Old West with
Joan Crawford.
Technicolor and Joan Crawford, like it scratches a very particular itch in Wizard's brain. So yeah,
campy,
it's an easy 20.
Yeah,
muchos camp.
Yeah,
yeah.
So the reason why I was looking at the spreadsheet is because I started to panic when I realized my pick. So my pick is directed by what's his name? Nagisa Oshima. And I realized in the middle of the show here that that's the same director as Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence.
And yes!
And I panicked because I gave that movie a 6. I did not like that movie. So I would not,
Yeah,
I would not on purpose pick another one of his movies.
Then don't. I think you had a couple options.
What are we
going to
watch, man? I hope we haven't seen it.
But it is going to over. But I'm being outweighed by just the sheer list of countries that this film was banned in. That is very intriguing to me. So I'm gonna go within the realm of the senses. By Nagisa Oshima, 1970s.
Oh, wait a minute. Is this the one that is so awful that everyone's pretty much assured that I'm going to be traumatized by it?
I don't think so.
No.
No. Okay. All right.
I don't think so. Crossed. Although I think there is some like.
This is
I think it's
going to
be an interesting
psychosexual
watch.
Drama.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk to us about
someone.
This, Court. Like, what makes you want to pick this? What is this and what makes you want to pick
it? It was strictly censored. It's still banned in Japan where it was made. A whole list of countries banned it upon coming out. It wasn't even available on video until the 1990s. Like, I don't know. something that so many people didn't want me to see makes me want to watch it, and it also makes me want to subject you all to watching it too.
I love it.
The infamy.
Yeah, and
this is before Mr. Oh, yeah, so it's before Mr. Christmas.
Yeah, it's before. I tend to like a lot of people's like earlier work anyway, so like we'll see. And it is in the Criterion Collection, so yeah.
Does it have a spy number? What's the spy number, just for shits and giggles?
466.
Oh, it's an early one. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, in the realm of the senses, that's what we'll be watching next week.
Sure, why not?
So nice. Listeners, you're watching the show, you're listening to the show, not watching it so much, but you know, you can also watch this movie and then listen to the show with us and have things to say. You can even email us or find us on the socials. We're on Instagram and Threads at Crit Club Podcast. You can email us, which is, I know, so old fashioned. I've heard complaints about this. You can email us at critclubpodcast@gmail.com. You can direct message us on those socials as well, and we shall respond. We don't have any messages for this week, but, we still have more show to go. We have the final part of our show.
Who's complaining about email? It's instantaneous communication.
Yeah, who's complaining about
email? It's only revolutionary, you shitbirds.
Well, use whatever communication method you would like to let us know how you think about the movies we've watched, past movies, movies you'd like us to see. We want to hear from you. So, write something out. Maybe you'll hear us talk about you on the show, which can
definitely
be fun
will.
And make you feel important. Fun times. So now that we're done with the main part of our show, we have the final part, which is what we're watching when we're not watching Criterion Channel films, called What You're Watching. And, I always want to know what Wizard is watching, because he has such a delightful sense of cinema vis-a-vis Johnny Guitar Western Camp. So what have you been watching, Wizard? Tell me all about
it. Oh my, what a lovely introduction to somebody who really does not have all that much to report, I'm afraid. I am continuing to watch FX's Shogun miniseries. Mm. It is very fun. It's a fun drama. It's got some fun visuals. It is a weeaboo's dream. And I think that has a lot going for it. I guess it's based on the story of the original weeaboo. So that's cool. But I would recommend it. It's fun. It's like everybody's acting the hell out of it. And at first I was like, I don't know if I enjoy the tone of this series. Like, it is like grim and gritty, and then like slightly humorous, and I don't know. It's a good series. It's super fun. Go samurai. Weeaboos, we love you. Love yourself. what else could I say? I was all set to see Immaculate, starring Sydney Sweeney, last night, her pregnant nun movie. But I unfortunately couldn't make it at the last minute, so I'm gonna try and see that another time. And I am playing Helldivers, which is super fun.
Let's play again.
We should play again. We've got some we have to defend some systems from the onslaught of the bots. I know there's a lot of bug players out there who don't want to shoot robots, but goddamn it, those robots need shooting. Super Earth needs saving. So we want you. Anyways, that's what I got.
Thank you, Wizard. I'm always excited to hear Peter's picks, because he and I have a similar sense of cinema, and he finds things that I've never heard of. So I want to, although he watches way more horror than I could ever stomach. So totally curious what you watch, and hopefully maybe something other than horror. Maybe not.
No, it's been a slow week. Really busy with work and really busy with lots of long runs, which kind of puts me out of commission for more things. And I haven't been to the theater in a couple of weeks, which is like driving me crazy. So, what I did see is I finally saw David Fincher's The Killer. Does anybody else watch that?
Watch his newest Fassbender?
One? Yeah, Michael Fassbender, assassin movie. I don't think I've had a conversation with anybody who's watched it, but I can't think of like another movie. It's hard for me to think of another movie that is so harmed by its voiceover. Ooh. Like, I kept, like, the voiceover
That's
is
a Corey Blade Runner complaint. Yeah.
It's
Deep
fucking
cover?
Crazy. Like, I don't Deep know. Cover. This movie is fucking, it's funny. But this movie is like, he's chatting the whole time. Like, the character on screen is so, like, quiet and methodical and, you know, process oriented, but the voiceover is like a completely different movie, and he's just chatting nonstop and like cultural references and like weird jokes. Like, I'm really curious if other people had the same feeling. Like, after a while I was like, I should just turn off the sound, because this is actually probably a pretty great and interesting movie just with no voiceover, because it's not needed.
I love the idea of a stone cold killer movie that is just his inner monologue nattering away. Like, did I leave the gas on? Shit, do I have soy milk?
I know, maybe people liked it. I think I didn't hear bad things about it. I think people genuinely liked it, but I was left kind of cold. I did watch a pretty good Australian horror movie called You'll Never See Me. You'll Never Find Me. It came out this last year. It's, you know, vibes. A good vibes horror movie if you're looking for it. It's on Shudder.
Ooh, I love
and
vibes.
Then I think the best, yeah, I don't know, the best time I've had in the movies or this past week, besides watching, continuing to watch Cheers that I talked about last week, is I did a rewatch of the 2006 Nicolas Cage, The Wicker Man. The Wicker Man, the original Wicker Man, is one of my top 10 movies of all time. I will watch it several times a year. Would you say, Corey?
That's crazy. It's top 10.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Have you watched that movie? It's fucking incredible. Have you watched it 14, 15 times?
To be clear, Peter's preference is for the original Wicker Man.
1974.
Yeah. No, I haven't seen the Nick Cage one. I've just seen the original.
Oh
no. And it is the Nicolas Cage one. Like it's a
completely different movie.
Really bad. Like really, it was fun. It's fun. But I had it on while I was like working. So like if I had sat down like with the intention of watching a movie, I would not enjoy the rewatch of this. But everyone, you know, they talk about like a specific actor or speaker, specific whatever is in like a different movie than everybody else. Every single person is in a different movie than the other one is. And
Ellen
also
Burstyn's
the director
in a
thinks
great movie in that
boy, it is wildly bad. Great time. Had a great time rewatching that remake of one of my top 10 movies. I guess that's it. I guess we'll leave it at that. Not a great bumper crop this year or this week. I'll try next week.
Corey, what you been watching?
I can't remember if I talked last week about The Program, documentary on Netflix.
So.
Maybe I watched that right after.
Is that another cult movies. Doc?
Yeah, I love mm-hmm. cult docs. Did I talk about it last week?
No, but you just like cult okay. docs.
Yeah, so like it's a bit misleading. I mean, I think they put cults in the title just to like get people like me to watch it, but it is actually about extremely abusive evangelical Christian like Oof. Schools that are supposed to be like reforming bad kids, and it just goes into like how horrible they absolutely are and how they're not even real schools. So like the people that graduated from them don't even get degrees or anything like that, don't get high school diplomas because they're not even real schools. And how this guy has been doing this for since the 70s, like worldwide, this network of schools with all this like crazy abuse and stuff in it, and he's still fine and super rich and getting away with it. And
good for him.
Yeah,
ritualized child abuse, Christianity.
Yeah,
Christianity.
It's,
at
it,
its
and
best,
it was
right?
really. I really loved the. Filmmaker who was one of the students there, who has, you know, now been gathering like all the people and finding people on, you know, the internet, and like she's the sort of like, so it follows like her story through it as well, and she's just a lovely, you know, human who you can also see is like extremely, you know, hurt and damaged by this sort of, you know, institutionalized abuse that happened to her at this. So
do you see that is self-referential documentary filmmaking, which is different from what we saw in Hearts and Minds?
Oh, yeah.
Because she talks about what she's doing, and it provides kind of a more transparent context to the story she's telling.
For sure.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sounds kind of cool.
It was really good. And then I sort of have also just like accidentally watched this other documentary that is also about like kids being abused. It is about Nickelodeon in the
late
90s
or
2000s.
Whoa. Wow.
Yeah, Quiet on the Set. Yeah. And it's focusing on like Dan Schneider, the guy who made like all that, and iCarly and Drake and Josh and all those shows or whatever. But it's also kind of like the people that were like orbiting around him also that were also abusing kids and stuff. And that one is still coming out right now. I think their final episode comes out next month. But yeah, it's also like really good and like just scary and terrible. And then I don't know. I started playing Gravity Rush 2. Has anybody played Gravity Rush?
Yeah, I did play the first one.
Okay.
On a PlayStation Vita.
Yeah. Okay.
But I did not play the second one. I always thought it'd be fun if you could probably bought it for like $5.
Yeah. It came like included with like PlayStation subscription or whatever. And
it's fun.
I'm looking for something I have to stop playing Binding of Isaac. I just have to get away from that for a while.
Did you not complete your mission?
No, I've not completed my mission. We're reaching an unhealthy stage in our relationship. Mm. And so I'm taking a break. I had always stayed away from Gravity Rush because I thought that it was like a puzzle game. It just has the name of a game that sounds like a puzzle game.
That makes sense. I see that.
And it's just not. It's this person who can like control her own personal gravity. So she like flies around and it's like a like action platform and there's like a combat system based on it. And like you're in, but like the plot is extremely like mundane and boring considering that she's someone who can control her own gravity and they live in like cities in the sky. But like the gameplay is just so much fun. And it's like, I don't know. I love really diving into, they're usually like Japanese developed games that have these like strange deep combat mechanics and stuff. And so like, it's scratching a good itch for me. So yeah, I'm enjoying this older.
That was one that like, I loved that first one and I always thought it deserved a better audience. And I was like glad it got a sequel, but I never played it. Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah. I'm skipping right to the second one.
A lot of fun.
Yeah. So I might go back and play
That's the way to go.
It's good.
Yeah. That's Angela. What are you watching?
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I've been on the road this week for spring break, visiting family. And so I haven't been able to watch nearly as much as I normally would. But I did catch a little bit of Girls 5 Eva on Netflix, which is written by Robert Carlock or produced by him, which is the whole like Tina Fey situation. Mm-hmm. There are some really fantastic cameos in that show with Stephen Colbert and Tina Fey that are completely unexpected. It's not nearly as snappy as 30 Rock, but how can you follow 30 up Rock with anything? And then Kimmy Schmidt. Girls 5 Eva is great and funny and silly, but sometimes, you know, misses the mark a little bit, but still super fun to watch. I'm only a couple episodes in. Totally, I would watch it because I had a surreal moment in Tina Fey's first cameo. I don't want to ruin it for you, Peter, because it is a surprise, because when you first see it, you're just like, what am I watching right now? And that is indeed Tina Fey. And I hope that you do watch it because I would love to hear your reaction.
Yeah, I've meant to for like a year. Yeah, and I just haven't gotten to it.
I'm also reading an Ursula K. Le Guin book, Lavinia. Lavinia. It's her book from like 2008. She is a Portland writer and her book, The Lathe of Heaven, is one of my all-time favorite books. And this new book that I'm reading of hers follows a lot of the same themes and it's just hitting me in the guts and I adore. I'm already halfway through. I only started it two days ago.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, how that goes. I think the world of her.
She's amazing. She writes a lot about dreams and how dreams affect how decisions that people make or the extent to which dreams can portend the future. And I find that stuff absolutely fascinating. I read
the Wizard of Earthsea books when I was like a young lad. And I think I tried to read them again. I did try to read them again like a couple of years ago and it didn't really hold up. Some pretty proto like Harry Potter stuff, but like Left Hand of Darkness, like a lot of her short stuff. Like I've always meant to read more because I actually think she's a stupendously good writer.
Wait, have you read The Lathe of Heaven?
No,
that's
no.
The best one out of all of them. Okay, like, great. I feel like you in particular would love it, actually.
Sure. Yeah. I love Left Hand of Darkness. I think about Left Hand of Darkness all the time.
But two other things I just want to talk about because they're tickets that are going on sale of two entertainment acts that I think everyone should be paying attention to. One is Laura Ramoso, who is a German-Italian-American woman who does stand up and like does these hilarious send-ups of her parents that are very incredibly relatable. And she is going on tour at the end of this year. And so check, it's Laura, Laura Ramoso. Highly recommend her. Hilarious. See her on TikTok all the time. And then my favorite band of the last year is Nation of Language. And they are a Brooklyn synth pop band. And Blonde Redhead is opening for them, I think, or other way around.
Oh, nice.
And they are going on tour later this year. Weak in Your Light is my favorite song of the last 5 years. And that's Nation of Language. So I'm really excited. I thought I missed them on tour. So I'm just super stoked that they are going on the road again. And that's what I'm watching. And I also just want to say, I always do appreciate what Corey recommends because he has a sense of justice in all of the TV watching that he does. And so, you know, it's always going to be a critique about either religion or America. And, you know, we need more people to be raising their voices about stuff like that. So thank you, Corey.
Well, and you, and I'm sorry, you mentioned stand up, and I just Tig Notaro just came out with a new stand up, and it's the one that I saw her when she was touring, like, do. And so I rewatched it. And I'm like, oh, this is just as good the second time. So I don't know the name of it, but it was really good.
Checking that out. Anybody else have any last minute recommendations?
No. Oh, I did watch a good documentary about the Berkeley Marathon. I don't know if you all are familiar with like that. The Berkeley, I don't know how I watched a whole documentary about it, but I didn't remember. Yeah, the Barclay, not the Berkeley, Barclay Marathon. It was a documentary that was like, it was actually pretty interesting to watch after all of our talk on Hearts and Minds, but it's like this Barclay Marathon in Tennessee that is kind of fucking insane. That's like somewhere around 100 miles, but probably around like 110 miles or something. Like it's actually a lot of fun of a watch. It's on Peacock, and I had known nothing about this as a long distance runner myself. It's like a pretty fun and digestible marathon about like this sort of weird little event. So I would really recommend the Barclay Marathon documentary.
Cool.
Well, I think that is our show for this week. Once again, next week we're going to be watching, what is it, Corey? Something that's been banned forever.
In the Realm of the Senses.
So hopefully you all will watch that too, and you'll be able to hear us talk about it next week. But for now, that's our show. Thanks for listening.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Thank Bye.
You. Bye. Bye. Bye.